The growth of the web has meant that governing the gigantic global community that uses it has become a technological and social and civic challenge for institutions that in some cases almost accidentally ended up playing the role of masters of the universe, such as the case for the institution ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. ICANN has begun the largest expansion ever in generic top-level domains, or GTLDs. That means that .com, .org, and .edu will now share space on the web with all kinds of new addresses like .build, .college, .wedding. But there is tension in this new world. Michael Frumkin is a professor of law at the University of Miami. He believes ICANN has been too heavy-handed in its control of the new domains, while Cyrus Namazi, vice president of domain name system services at ICANN, says it's an exciting, brave new world.
There's really no hierarchy being designed into the new rollout of the expansion program. So what you're going to see is, as an example, New York City is going to have a .nyc top-level domain. So most people then will be able to identify the programs that the city offers for its citizens, for its tourism programs, and so on and so forth. People who are looking for information for City of New York, for instance, will be assured that it's actually a legitimate website they're going to because it's going to be managed by the City of New York.
Does this create a brand protection problem, though, Michael Frumkin, in the sense that now you've got 120 different Disneys out there potentially, and that people could much more easily copy, or that businesses and brands that need to be protected have to acquire all of these domains as well?
Well, if you're a very large, what we call famous mark, then of course you have an interest in doing that. But that's no different from anything else we create, whether it's local signage, street naming, magazines, or anything else. I mean, that's just part of life in the trademark world. If I may, I'd like to go back to the issue about price, because I think that's actually very important. It's not obvious that this is going to create the kind of price competition we might have hoped for, in part because the barriers to entry into getting into the new GTLD program were very high. Most of the estimates I've seen put the total cost that it took from soup to nuts to get a domain name approved at about $1 million. That's really high.
That is really high. Why would it be so high?
I can try to address that perhaps. So the expansion of the top-level domain name within the internet hierarchy is a substantial undertaking, both from a logistics perspective, from a technical perspective, from a policy perspective. Also, running a top-level domain name requires an entity to have both financial means as well as the credentials and credibility of the people that run it so that they can be trusted with a license to operate that TLD.
How do you evaluate that, though? I mean, what do you do when somebody applies for a domain name that is obviously critical of someone or something, even insulting almost?
Sure. So the program actually took about 6 years of thinking and the community coming together and evaluating and investigating all different pitfalls and benefits and pros and cons of it. There is substantial due diligence that's done for each particular application before it's allowed to proceed forward toward becoming live on the internet.
I really want to challenge the assumption both of you are operating under, which is that ICANN has any business doing that at all. And to its credit, most of the time it's tried to avoid doing that. And this was sort of an exception. I'm very supportive of the idea of expanding the number of GTLDs. I mean, some of us have been arguing for this since before ICANN even existed. But the way that it's been done, ICANN inserted itself into the process. And instead of passing on the technical and perhaps financial bona fides and resiliency of the applicants, also wanted to pass on the strings, the names, as to whether they were proper or not. And I don't think that was a good idea.
So you believe complete free speech, totally open source, unregulated domain names?
Well, largely, yeah. I mean, there are some limits. You don't want misleading ones where it looks or sounds too much like one that's already there. So I think there absolutely is a gatekeeping function for keeping out those sort of semi-fraudulent attempts.
So, Cyrus, a brave new world, exciting new world, or sort of cautious steps? And you get the last word here.
It's absolutely a brave new world. What's taking place here, John, is a brand new blank canvas for people, for businesses, for special interests, for communities to come together, put a stake into the ground, have their identity in the virtual world identified with their special interests. It's absolutely thrilling.
Cyrus Namazi and Michael Frumkin, thanks so much.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you.
Cyrus Namazi, Vice President of Domain Name System Services at ICANN. And Michael Frumkin is a professor of law at the University of Miami. So in contrast to the entrepreneurs greedily snapping up new domain names, there are huge communities, digitally speaking, that remain in the dark in America. Pew Research Center's Internet Project reports that among households with incomes of 30 grand or less, only 54% have access to broadband at home. One-third of those making less than $20,000 a year do not go online at all. But sometimes, deep in the poorest neighborhoods, you can get a signal.
Sometimes I do my homework and play games.
That's 10-year-old Natasha in the Bronx, pirating off a signal from Bernie Williams and Joshua Stevenson, who operate one of the city's housing authority Wi-Fi vans that circulate in underserved neighborhoods, encouraging little pirates to log on.
These are our two jetpack MiFis. It has 10 stations on each MiFi. So basically, we have four on each, and then we have the available slots for people when they come to want to connect their mobile devices to the network. And we also have a printer scanner right here. So basically, if people need to come in, we've had that too, where people need to come in and make copies, and we have that available to them as well.
Those voices, courtesy of our friends at WNYC New Tech City podcast. Wireless internet isn't a necessity for the poor, but after food, shelter, and clothing, it is a doorway to a better life, especially for school children, who increasingly rely on the internet for schoolwork and interactions with fellow students and teachers. In Kansas City, Missouri, Michael Limata has dedicated his life to the concept of internet for all. He's the co-founder and president of the nonprofit organization Connecting for Good. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So you really see this edge of people who have connectivity and people who don't, and in many cases the school children who really suffer by not having access to the internet when so many of their school friends actually do have it. What does that look like?
Well, here in Kansas City, the Kansas City Public School District, 70% of the children do not have internet at home. So it puts them at a tremendous disadvantage academically.
Now, do smartphones pick up the slack here? Is there a proliferation of smartphones in some of these communities? They're not cheap either.
You know, the adoption rate among urban core residents is just about the same as it is for suburbanites as far as smartphones go. However, we know that serious academic and even educational pursuits can't happen on a smartphone. To write essays and reports and to do any serious academic activity, you really need a keyboard and a full screen.
Do libraries constitute an option for low-income folks, or is it really a matter of building a fundamentally new infrastructure for people within the city limits?
You know, the libraries, you may go and wait for 2 hours to use the computer for 45 minutes because you've got a whole lot of people waiting behind you. Even in the idea of building community computing centers is fine, but there are many neighborhoods where you don't want kids out after dark. So we believe that only in-home access is the key.
And what about in-home appliances? I mean, you may have the internet access, but the question is, do you actually have a computer? Are these kinds of things on a subsidized basis available to low-income families with school kids?
Yes, well, again, our organization Connecting for Good has a threefold approach. First, we're using wireless mesh networks to bring low-income people, internet in places like public housing and low-income communities. We also have a computer refurbishing program where we can sell a low-income family a computer for as low as $50. And we require people to take two classes that we call digital life skills before we sell them a computer. So we're trying to hit it up at all different angles here to make sure that connectivity is possible.
Do you have a story of a family whose life has been changed by some of the kinds of things that you're able to set up for them?
Well, definitely. I think, you know, one of the things that we know is when it comes to employment, 70% of Fortune 500 companies require online applications. So we have a young lady who sought a job for over a year, the traditional means by calling and visiting. But when we got her a computer and connected, helped her with her resume, she got two job interviews and enrolled in online college to finish her degree in the first month after receiving help from us. We have many other stories of people who've gone out and completed their GED. And, you know, for many parents, it's just a great thing to be able to say, hey, I know where my kids are at night. They're working on the computer.
And who funds you? And it sounds like you believe that this really should be a broader statewide or citywide civic responsibility of a government to deliver.
Well, I think it's a big thing. When you have tens of thousands of people that aren't connected, it's not going to be one entity. We've been organizing here in Kansas City with both civic and corporate leaders as well as the general public. We're pretty much grant-funded, funded by contributions, and we've had some self-generated income through IT support for nonprofits and our computer refurbishing operations.
Let me ask you one headache question there, Michael. How many computers have you sold?
Last year, we put out over 600. They all came in through donations and went through our shop.
Right. And how many mesh networks?
We have set up a total of 4 mesh networks right now that supply free internet to about 500 families.
And do you have a customer support line when those families have problems doing something on their refurbished computer?
Actually, we've had very little need for that. We try to train people very thoroughly, and our customer support essentially is bring your computer in and we will give you a different one.
All right, and you haven't had much problem with that?
No, and I think it's because, we try to keep very quality machines out there. Probably, 30% of the computers that we get actually go to the public. 70% goes to recycling. So we feel, even though these may be low-income families, they deserve as best as we can give them as far as the quality of the machines.
Michael Leventhal is president and co-founder of Connecting for Good, a nonprofit that works to bridge that digital divide in Kansas City, Missouri. Thanks so much, Michael.
Good to be with you.
So building up our communities, how do we create a better home for everyone? Today we're talking about the destructive forces of addiction. You're telling us about friends and family members and personal stories about dealing with addiction in everyday life. From Washington, my friend OD'd in January, just weeks before Philip Seymour Hoffman. Such a sad situation. With every loss, the use of heroin is so dedicated to actually be willing to take an illicit drug intravenously. The signs of addictive behavior must be recognized and addressed. We're so sorry for your loss. We want to hear all your thoughts. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Much more at thetakeaway.org.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.